Welcome to the Cybersecurity Readiness Podcast Series with Dr. Dave Chatterjee. Dr. Chatterjee is the author of the book Cybersecurity Readiness, a Holistic and High-Performance Approach, a Sage publication. He has been studying cybersecurity for over a decade, authored and edited scholarly papers, delivered talks, conducted webinars and workshops, consulted with companies, and served on a cybersecurity SWAT team with chief information security officers. Dr. Chatterjee is Associate Professor of Management Information Systems at the Terry College of Business, the University of Georgia. As a Duke University visiting scholar, Dr. Chatterjee is taught in the Master of Engineering and Cybersecurity program at the Pratt School of Engineering.
Hello, everyone. I'm delighted to welcome you to this episode of the Cybersecurity Readiness Podcast Series. Our discussion will revolve around ransomware attacks with a focus on three questions. Number one, what vulnerabilities of data backups do ransomware hackers exploit? Number two, what are the common mistakes and barriers when recovering against a ransomware attack? And number three, how to successfully recover from a ransomware attack. I'm delighted to welcome Gabe Gamble, Vice President of Product and Technical Operations at Quorum, to share his knowledge and expertise on this very significant topic. Welcome, Gabe.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Fantastic. So, Gabe, before we dive into the details, why don't you share with listeners some of your professional journey highlights?
Sure. So I've been in IT and disaster recovery for about 30 years. I started with a managed service provider working in the banking space. So we were everything from, you know, keyboard to edge for those customers, providing security, disaster recovery, planning, business continuity, the whole soup. And kind of worked my way from there into Quorum, where I've been for the last 14 years overseeing product and support for our product within the company.
Wow, that's a very succinct and humble narration of your very impressive professional journey. But, you know, often short has a stronger message. So short and sweet, as they say. Okay, let's move on then. Before we talk about, you know, how to protect against ransomware attacks, let's revisit ransomware attack as a phenomenon. What is it? Why don't you take the lead and I can always chime in if I need to.
Sure. So back in the day, you know, you had the whole concept of hackers breaking into companies to do various things. Really, it started out as a way to prove they could, right? And it wasn't as malicious as it is today. And then came the malware craze where they were stealing data, you know, putting keyloggers in and trying to get credit card numbers and that thing. And then the next logical step was ransomware, where they're taking your data and they're literally encrypting it right from under your nose and holding you accountable so that they can get money out of you to give you back your own data. So it's really theft on a whole new level.
Absolutely. And when I was doing my research for this podcast, one of the trends that got my attention was the fact that, you know, it is through phishing that the attackers gain access to the credentials. And that allows them to get into the network and launch the attack from within the network, whereby they encrypt and remove data before even the internal teams can respond. So I find the whole approach extremely innovative, not surprising that they recognize what they need to compromise, disable, to render the victim helpless and in their hands so they can demand whatever they want.
Yeah. So typically someone who attacks with ransomware, they're in your environment for 6 to 9 months before they unleash the ransomware. So that means that they're set up keyloggers, they've set up backdoors, they've set up all kinds of things. They've watched you log into your backup so that they can try to get onto your backups to delete them. They install spyware. They do all kinds of things so that if you try to get them out, they just come right back. They're like a bad penny.
Wow. You know, so something interesting I noted, it seems that there has been a slight reduction in the volume of ransomware attacks. I'm referring to a stat which says the volume of ransomware attacks dropped 23% in 2022 compared to the previous year. Yep. However, from a global perspective, it's still pretty significant, like 623.3 million ransomware attacks happened globally in 2021. 66% of the organizations in 2023 were affected by ransomware. So maybe the volume has dropped, but still it is a pretty significant and popular type of attack. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. And the horrible part about that stat is that's the reported volume.
Yes.
So what we found is in recent times, more people are paying and not talking about it, which is the worst thing you can do in that situation.
Yes. Talking about paying the ransomware, I've done a few episodes on this topic, and one of the subject matter experts was very pragmatic when he said that, look, no organization wants to pay. That's not the desired approach. However, they have to be practical. They have to be realistic. They have to get their operations going. So they often end up paying. That is definitely not the recommended best practice, but it happens. However, again, what I gather from the media that the attackers haven't been very successful in gathering ransom of the magnitude they desire. So that may have been the reason for the drop. I don't know. Just a thought.
I don't know that. I mean, I'll give you a perfect example was the Palace versus the MGM attacks in Las Vegas, right? These were paid and they were up in a few days and MGM didn't. And it took them weeks to get up. But the difference is 80% of people that are hit with ransomware are hit again. So if I'm the ransomware person, who am I going to attack? I'm going to attack Caesars again. I know they're going to pay. So there's the trade-off there between, you know, the right thing to do and the hard thing to do, right?
Yeah. Based on the stats that I've gathered, it takes a minimum of 3 to 4 weeks to recover. And that is for reasonably well-prepared organizations. It can be even worse for those who are not prepared. I had the pleasure of interviewing some incident response experts from Europe, and they do that for a living, very hands-on. They had a lot of recommendations to share, which I might bring in later on in the discussion. But bottom line, what they said was very plain and simple, that you need to be aware of where your data resides. And they were very big on backing up data from core storage, not from the image files. And we can talk about that later. But sure. Bottom line, this is a huge problem. It has expanded to supply chains, so it's having a cascading impact. The nature of extortion has evolved. I was reading about this triple extortion effect. Sometimes somebody said a quadruple extortion. Bottom line, the attackers are trying a variety of ways to squeeze the victim so that they pay up. And then what was fascinating, well, I don't know if fascinating is the right word, but concerning, that ransomware as a service is now in existence.
That's the number one way it's spreading right now, actually, is now anybody can go into the black web and get ransomware and target a customer. So if I'm a disgruntled employee, I could target my old company. I pay the ransomware creator whatever percentage, 10, 15%, and I extort my own company. And they don't know it's me, but I have inside information that gets me into the account and does all the nefarious things I want to do. It's horrible now. It's a horrible situation where it basically is like franchising ransomware.
So what that means is an organization wants to hit its competitors. They can go to the dark web and have a team launch an attack against their competitors, right?
Scary thought, but yes, absolutely.
Yeah, that's very, very concerning. But anyhow, we have a problem on hand. When we were having our planning meeting, I really liked the way you presented the topic of discussion today, and that is going back to the title that we have here, the last line of defense against a ransomware attack.
Right.
So what exactly is the last line of defense?
Well, the last line of defense are your backups. So it's like an onion. You're going to have multiple layers of defense. You're going to have security layers on your perimeter. You're going to have antivirus. You're going to have endpoint protection. You're going to have things in your network doing scans, right? There's all kinds of things you can do to provide layers of protection into your environment. The last layer is your backup. When all of those fail, and eventually they do because, as you said earlier, the way they attack is not through vulnerabilities as much. The main way they attack is through phishing. So it's through somebody doing something wrong that lets them do what they want to do. And because of that, because people are the weakest link in your security plan, inevitably it's going to happen to everybody. And so defense, your last line of defense is your ability to recover from such a disaster. And so having a backup solution that isn't part of your network, that doesn't rely on single sign-on or your domain authentication or your storage platform or any of those other things. It has immutable backups. It has an air-gapped solution. It has multi-factor authentication to let you in. That's it. That's the last line. If you don't have something that you can recover, you have no choice but to pay the ransom. And that's a scary, scary situation to be in for people.
I couldn't agree with you more. You're spot on. In fact, when we talk about data backups, the way I look at it is whether it is at the individual level or at the organizational level, we've got to prioritize. We are not going to be able to provide the same level of protection to all types of data. So we have to decide what's most important to us. And once we've made that decision, then we have to go full blast, providing that defense in depth kind of security. And like you said, we have to store data or backup data online, offline, and practice restoration of data, the backed up data from the different offline locations, just to make sure that when you really get hit, how quickly, not only quickly, how effectively you recover. So how soon can you resume normal operations? That's the way I look at it as a big picture, that if I can secure the data that's most critical to me by maintaining an offline copy, and I know sometimes it may not be the latest version, but something is better than nothing. What do you think? What are your thoughts?
Okay, so there's a lot of pieces to that. So the first thing you got to talk about is how it affects the company versus how it affects the technology, right? So your data is encrypted, but the bigger hit of that is, do I unencrypt it now or do I do the right thing? And that's the hard decision. So the first thing you need to do is contact your cybersecurity insurance provider and say, okay, this has happened. These are my next steps. You know, what can I do? Then you need to build or have a clean room environment. Because when you recover, you can't recover back on your network. Because like I said, they've been in your environment for 9 months. You got to find out everywhere they're in your environment and get them out first before you go back to production. So there's a whole part of forensics, security forensics that has to happen before you can go back into production. Then you can start putting things back into production and enabling that plan. But before you can do, you know, the final step, which is put yourself back online and get your users back up, those interim steps take a long time. Because instead of being the technical part of the discussion where, how do I recover? Oh, I click the button here and I hit the slash here and okay, I'm back up, right? If I had a tornado, recovery is a lot easier. But if I have a ransomware attack, now it's no longer a technical discussion. It's now a business discussion. Do I pay? What's the effect of PR? What's the trust factor? What data has been compromised? Are my customers at risk? Those kind of discussions are what take the time and take the effort to do. And what we found is people do the technical tests for discovery or for recovery all the time, right? People are nowadays, not everybody tests, but most people test their recovery plan. They know they can recover. Nobody does the white table discussion and sits down and goes, okay, how does this affect the company? And that's the pain point, right? Get the CEO in the room, get the guys and go, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to go through if this happened, how it affects you. Now it's a different conversation and that's what needs to happen more.
You know, it's interesting. You brought up the CEO. I was just recording an episode, which will be released in a few weeks, on tabletop exercises.
Yep.
And we were talking about how tabletop exercises need to go beyond the technical aspect.
Yeah.
It has to be much more holistic, where you have to, like you said, when you have a ransomware attack problem, every aspect of the business is affected. And you're having to engage with the media, with your stakeholders, legal is involved. So unless you rehearse, all the pieces of the puzzle needs to fall in place.
Yes.
As opposed to doing it in bits and pieces. And sometimes, you know, there is a propensity, and they agreed, the subject matter expert agreed, there's a propensity to assume, oh, we've done the parts of it. If it were to happen, we'll figure it out. You know, that's like preparing for a math exam and practicing a few problems and saying, you know, I should be good. You know, I don't need to practice the very hard ones, because whatever I have learned and I know the fundamentals, I'll be able to apply it and get and be good. But it never works out that way.
Oh, I agree. To extend on your analogy, it's like taking a physics exam, but you've practiced all the math, right? If you don't know how to apply it, it's useless.
You have to practice for the worst. And that's when the worst happens, you are really prepared. Again, I'm going to bring in another analogy. I'm a huge tennis fan. When the top players are practicing, they are practicing more intensely than they would play the match. It is that level of intensity focus that is required to be really prepared to reduce the damage from ransomware attacks, to enhance the resiliency of organizations. But yeah, that's very interesting. So share with the listeners, you've already alluded to them, what are some common mistakes and barriers when recovering from a ransomware attack?
Well, the most common thing that I've found is when they recover from ransomware, they don't contact their insurance first. And the bad part about that, whether you're going to pay, whether you're not going to pay, all of those discussions, if you didn't contact your insurance first, chances are they're not going to pay you back. So whatever your outcome of doing it, whether you're getting things because, hey, I didn't pay, but I need to get, you know, offset my costs because I had to do this or that, you know, security, forensics had to come in. If I didn't contact insurance first, chances are they're not going to pay me. So that's the biggest mistake I see, is they're not contacting their insurance first. They're not getting the insurance's legal team involved first. Definitely the biggest mistake I see people make. The next thing I see them make is they rush the recovery. They come back in, they put their stuff back online thinking they got it before the thing, everything's going to be fine. They didn't do any forensics and the back door is still there, and they come back in and attack again. And when they attack the second time, now they see what they missed the first time and they make it worse. So that's the other big mistake I see, is people rush the recovery to get back online versus get online safely. In their backup procedures, you know, on the technical side, the mistakes that I often see people make is they want everything to be integrated and simple. And there is a level for that in your production environment that is necessary. You need a domain. You want single sign-on. You want all of these things. In your backups, you want none of that. You want zero trust, because that's the piece that has to recover when all the rest of it's dead. And so you want that to be the most secure area of your network. You want it to trust nothing else. You want it to have different passwords. That's the okay. So we had a customer that we came across, and they had their administrator password was used for their backup password. Same password. When they elevated their credentials within the environment and they got the administrator password, they tried it and they were able to log into the backups. Don't be that guy. Have a unique password for your backups that's different from everything else, and limit who can access the backup environment. In the recovery planning and then in the testing environment, They don't test the right things. They test your ability to recover files or recover a server. They're not testing, how does my insurance company react? Did I bring them into my tabletop exercise? What do they, like, where is the border on, hey, their ransomware people have calculators that say, okay, this company is worth this much money. They can afford to pay this. So that's what they charge for ransomware. If you're not going to your insurance companies to know what they're going to cover, and you're not tabletopping that, you might make the wrong call. So being, as you said, holistic about the tabletop exercises is probably the biggest mistake. And then last but not least, the number one way they get in your environment is phishing. So they don't train enough. They think they have one training video that they've been spinning out for 5 years and it's always the same. It gets worse and worse, especially now with AI, right? Now attackers can leverage AI to make these emails even more believable, more unique, less template looking, so that when they're hitting you, it looks like, you know, your Uncle Bob is sending you an email and all of a sudden he's in your network. It's a very scary thing. And so that constant amount of training is really critical.
Very true. In fact, I'd like to add a couple of things to what you already shared.
Sure.
And this again comes back from my discussion with the incident response folks. And I'm going to quote them here. I think it's a very profound quote. One of the things they said was, the best thing that leadership team can do is to give the incident responders and the IT department the support and the room to do their job, and not expect to have status update meetings every 30 minutes or every 2 hours, because that does not give us time to work and actually produce the stuff. So that's one thing they said. The other thing they said was that don't be in a rush to declare to the public, to the media, what you have found or what you haven't found while you're trying to recover. Now, there are two sides to it. There are regulations in place where a company can't stay silent too long. They have to be transparent and upfront. However, what these guys are saying, these hands-on incident responders, that if you rush it, you may misspeak and you may have to take back your words and say, you know, we thought nothing was damaged, but actually now we've found it. So the approach has to be a little more cautious, a little more deliberate. And then that syncs right back to what we were talking about is the practice aspect, that we have to check off all these boxes that from the point of, like you said, how to recover, how to deal with the different stakeholders, if you bring in people to help you recover, how to engage with them. These must be practiced. And it's not enough to have documentation. I've seen in many companies, they have great documentation that probably meets compliance requirements. But have you really practiced it? Does it really work? So
right. And do you follow it?
Yeah, exactly. If you follow it.
I've gone in with the DR manual and sat it on the desk and had the white table discussion with customers, and they don't do anything that's in their manual at all. Just kind of wing it. As you said, we'll figure it out. And that's the way they treat their ransomware thing, even though they have a set things of this is what you need to do. Not following that ends up to hurt them. And then the other piece that I want to add that affects the IT side of the world is unpatched vulnerabilities is the second most common way that they get into your environment. And companies have been really good about saying, hey, we have found a vulnerability in this. You need to patch it. And if you're not staying true to that, the hackers are. And so they're looking at that going, aha, this is another way I can attack this customer. So making sure that all your vulnerabilities on your application stacks, your coding stacks, your operating systems, your firewalls, your switches, all of the things that are public facing need to always be maintained.
And, you know, that begs a question. It would sound obvious that you must be proactive on top of, you know, patching your systems and your network. But then the question is, why aren't organizations on top of it? Why are they often reactive? Why is there a delay? What's been your experience?
So there's three reasons that there's a delay. Number one, they're not monitoring those things. So they're not looking at all of their applications for those vulnerabilities. They don't see them. So that's the first. The second is they tend to find themselves in a situation where they've created a structure, right? They're rigid. So they have change controls and they have a process to follow. And that becomes laborious and it becomes time consuming. And so they go, you know what? We'll do it quarterly or we'll do it every 6 months. And so they push it out and that increases the window of vulnerability for them. So they're so rigid about those that they don't do it. And then the other one is hard. You know, some companies and a law firm, those, they need their document servers to be up and running. And so they limit the times where they can implement a hotfix or something because they don't want to take those servers down because they work for the law firm and the law firm has to have those documents. So it's making those calls versus production versus security. That's the third reason that they really struggle to keep things up to speed.
Absolutely. And in the big scheme of things, Gabe, think about it. It means you're the CEO of a company. You've been hired to run the organization. You have directives, mission, goals. Cybersecurity is not on your radar. That's the unfortunate aspect of operations. It's something you have to do, but that's not what you want to focus on because it almost seems like it's taking away time from what you're supposed to be do and what you're going to be paid for, or for what, if you don't do it well, you might get fired. So the priority of being proactive about your defenses, including securing against cyber attacks, ransomware attacks. And you know, maybe it has to be regulation or compliance driven, because I can't expect the ideal scenario where a CEO will say that, you know what, no matter what we are trying to accomplish here, we must be very cyber ready. That's not going to be a natural reaction.
Right. No, that's absolutely true. And the other hard part about it is CISOs, right? The security operations people are probably the most in demand C-level executives right now. And there's just not enough people that are qualified. And a lot of people don't even want to do it because they feel that it just sets them up to be the scapegoat and they don't want to be that guy either. So unless you have a CEO that's really bought off on it, a lot of people go into CISO interviews and they go, nope, the company doesn't really want a CISO. They want a scapegoat. And I don't want to be that guy. I talk to CISOs all the time and they're like, yeah, I was going to, you know, take this job with a company, but they don't want to invest in it. They just want me to handle it. And I'm like, okay, well, it can't be a cost center, right? It's got to be something where it's part of the solution. So,
yeah. And, you know, that brings up the whole topic of CISO empowerment. And you're so spot on. You don't want to hire a CISO to make the person a scapegoat. You want to provide the person with the appropriate resources, authority, so that the person and the team can do the right thing for the company. In numerous episodes, senior leadership say that ideally the CISO should be reporting to the audit committee or to the board of directors or to the CEO. So make the function as objective as possible so they can call a spade, when they need to call a spade, and they can raise the alert when they need to raise the alert, as opposed to staying quiet and not wanting to cry foul, let's put it that way. But right. Bottom line is, yeah, I mean, I totally see where a person might be hesitant. And, you know, one more thing to that, Gabe, I don't know if you would agree, is the need for cross-functional ownership, where security, business needs to come together and jointly own this, because it's just not right to say, okay, if something went wrong, the security officer goes, because the security officer by themselves can't really secure everything. It's a partnership that needs to happen. So, and I'll let you talk. Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I agree with you. It's a holistic view, as you said, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Whole company has to be on board with the needs of that security team. Like I said, I talk to CISOs a lot. And one of the things that come back to me that I coach them on, and I tell them, if you're going into an interview about a CISO position, the first thing you need to ask is, what's the budget for security that's separate from IT? Because when they lump it together, the production IT costs override the security IT costs, and the security features aren't getting done. Yeah. And so you're basically tying your CISO's hands before he even gets his budget.
Yep, true.
And so if the CEO is not bought off on the security team needs to have its own funding, its own plan, it's going to cause an issue. And you all got to be on the same page for that.
You know, along those lines, if I was interviewing for a CISO job, I would also ask for proof in a subtle way. Let's put it that way, that, you know, show me how actively involved or engaged is top management. If something were to go wrong, who takes blame? Is it, am I the blame guy, or will there be others who will have shared responsibility?
Absolutely.
So it really boils down to the seriousness of the commitment. Because, you know, in a court of law, again, I draw upon my experience of talking to a lot of legal experts. I'm not a legal expert, but I draw from that discussion. They have emphasized that courts of law are very reasonable in their expectations. They recognize a company with what kind of resources they have. They want to ensure that you haven't been grossly negligent. So I would like to believe that if a meticulous approach is followed, where you're trying to check off all the boxes, do the right things, have monitoring, continuous monitoring, providing oversight. Yeah, it costs money. Yeah, you have to invest people. But then that's what you do proactively to prevent a reputational damage. And, you know, for small businesses, one ransomware attack, and the business is dead. It has happened time and again. The larger organizations often survive, and that could very well be the motivation by where they could be thinking, you know what, we are too big, we are too valuable. If we get hacked and something bad were to happen, we'll still survive, right? But that's not an option for smaller businesses. So the fear factor, unfortunately, has to come into play for organizations to raise their game and do the best they possibly can. So that's kind of my two cents.
Absolutely. And, you know, along with that, they have to have a situation or an environment where they're open to change. One of the hardest things to implement in a company right now is multi-factor authentication, which sounds so silly because it's so popular and everyone's doing it, but there's so many exceptions to the rule, right? Oh, everybody has it except Steve. He couldn't figure it out. So Steve is still on a regular password. Okay, well, Steve is your guy that's going to get hacked, right? I mean, that's what you're setting poor Steve up to be, is the keystone that's going to make the whole tower tumble.
I have to add something here. So I learned, very interesting, that it is the developers who hate multi-factor authentication.
Yes, and the QA people, right? Because they're logging in and out and in and out and in and out all day long. Yeah, I get that. Them and the C-level executives, right? They live on their phone, and so their need to use multi-factor authentication is super frustrating, and they don't want to have anything to do with it. So yeah, I see that a lot. I see that a lot.
Fascinating. Well, let's move along. I think we are kind of coming towards the end of our discussion here. You've touched upon a lot of this, but again, a little bit of redundancy and reinforcement never hurts. What would you say are some best practices out there to successfully recover from a ransomware attack?
So on the technical aspects, the best practice is test often. Bring up all your servers in a clean room, test environment, however you want to call it. Provide a solution for your backup and your strategy that's a zero trust environment. Make sure it's air gapped. Whether that's logical or physically, it should be air gapped, which means it has no wire connected to your network. Have immutable backups. Have a cybersecurity policy. Test that policy. Use that policy. Call them. That's their job. Ask them questions. Bring them into your tabletops. Have a security forensics team on staff or on standby ready to go. Test, train, test, train.
If I could add one more to that list, I think it's a fantastic list that you just shared. And that one more thing would be involve legal from the get-go, because ultimately they will be involved when something were to happen and you have to go to a court of law. So why not pick their brains early, making sure you're doing everything that the law expects you to do?
No, that's absolutely true. And I should have split that out. Often when I talk about insurance, most cybersecurity people have a legal team that they work like that you're assigned to or that you work with. So that's the legal you would pull in on that. But yeah, absolutely. Insurance, legal, and forensics, those three things need to be pre-selected and pre-tested.
Hey, this was fascinating. Fantastic. I so appreciate your time. Like in all episodes, I want my guests to have the final say. So this is your time to share some final thoughts.
Sure. Ransomware is not a technical problem, and it needs to not be treated as a technical problem. It is a company-wide problem. It needs to involve every level of the company, knowing how to respond, how to test, how to make those hard decisions, because they are very hard decisions when you're in the fire. And if you don't have some guideline or some pre-selected thing, chances are you'll make the wrong decision and you'll regret it. Have a good server recovery strategy to remain immune to these pitfalls. Test against ransomware as well as disasters, and make sure that you have a team around you that really wants to be a secure and protected environment. Oh, the other thing I want to bring up, one more thing.
Sure.
The FBI and the CISA, which is the Central Intelligence Security Administration, I think I got that right, have actually formed an international group to help fight ransomware that is starting to become very effective. So if you report it to the FBI, to your local police, to whoever, it actually all funnels in together to one central group, and they are working very actively to take these guys down. They just took one down last week where they actually hacked the hacker and took down their site, which I thought was a phenomenal strategy. But to my point of that, it is never the wrong thing to do the right thing. And it might hurt more in the short term, but by reporting it, you give them more information on how to find the right codes to get your data back, find the right Bitcoin traffic to get your money back, and do the right things to take these guys down permanently. So I can't stress that enough to be a route that you take is to report your findings, because it enables everybody on the other side to be more effective.
Well, thank you so much. I'm going to break my rule and add something or emphasize something you said, and that is to form that partnership with FBI. It has been mentioned before, and I'm glad you mentioned it. It really helps to partner up with them. They're very, very willing to help. And so again, it should be proactive, not when disaster has struck, but before disaster strikes. Now, partner up with FBI, and like you said, they have an international network, so you can share in the resources and fight this war together, because we are much stronger together than if you try to do this in isolation.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you again, Gabe. It has been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
A special thanks to Gabe Gamble for his time and insights. If you like what you heard, please leave the podcast a rating and share it with your network. Also, subscribe to the show so you don't miss any new episodes. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you in the next episode.
The information contained in this podcast is for general guidance only. The discussants assume no responsibility or liability for any errors or omissions in the content of this podcast. The information contained in this podcast is provided on an as-is basis with no guarantee of completeness, accuracy, usefulness, or timeliness. The opinions and recommendations expressed in this podcast are those of the discussants and not of any organization.